Kids think it's gross. Parents blush to speak of it. But let's face it, everybody gets conceived the same way. Making Babies is the title of anatomist David Bainbridge's new book, but he's got more than an academic interest in the subject. When his first child, Eleanor, recently came screaming into the world, Bainbridge fell in love with the science of pregnancy. He told Steve Paulson the road to birth is fraught with mystery. To begin with, why does the mother's body accept this tiny visitor?
It really seems to be part of this general takeover that the baby does of the mother's system. But one of the things that people realise almost as soon as people started to work on organ transplantation and tissue grafting was they realised that in some ways, potentially, the baby may behave in some sort of strange way as a tissue graft, because obviously it gets half of its genes from its father, so half of the things it has on its surface may be from the father, and yet the mother doesn't appear to recognise it as foreign. There's probably lots of different tricks and ways that it actually manages to do that, but one of the most remarkable is that there does seem to be a shift in the mother's immune system during pregnancy. Obviously, she's not completely immunosuppressed like somebody is who's being treated after an organ transplant, because obviously that would be dangerous for her and the baby. But there do seem to be very real changes in the way that her immune system works. So the baby really does seem to take over in a very aggressive way.
Do the egg and the sperm play more or less equal roles in the shaping of the baby?
In many ways, I like to think of this as the actual difference between males and females, is that one thing that's very noticeable about eggs and sperm is obviously sperm are very, very small. They're just about the smallest cell in the whole body, and many of the features of the way they're put together are really designed to make them as small as possible. Whereas if you compare them with an egg, the egg is certainly one of the biggest cells in the body. Relative to most cells, it's absolutely huge. So what you have when a sperm enters an egg is you have a very unequal combination of material. Basically, all the sperm does is provide nearly half the genes for the embryo, whereas the mother provides just over half the genes for the embryo. But more importantly than that, the egg is absolutely packed full of machinery to really guide the embryo's first few days of development. And certainly for the first few days of development, the development of a baby is very much controlled by things that have been put in the egg specifically for that purpose by the mother. And it's not really until those few days are up that the baby's own genes actually start to kick in and control its own destiny. So the sperm is very, although you always think of it as the active partner, actively in a very sort of machismo sort of way, swimming towards the egg, yet once it's actually got in the egg, the roles are very much reversed. The sperm is very much passive and very much at the whim of the egg.
Does it matter very much which of the father's sperm manages to get into the egg? If a different sperm gets there first, will a very different baby result?
Yes, very much so. What happens when men make sperm and women make eggs, they basically discard half of their genes. This is part of the Faustian pact that they have to enter into when they decide to breed by sexual reproduction. They have to throw away half their genes, so only half of their genes are packaged into each sperm. And so obviously each sperm gets a different 50% of the genes. And so which sperm enters the egg very much affects the outcome for the baby.
And I suppose this may explain why there are so many sperms that that men produce. Maybe there's something of the survival of the fittest.
To be honest, nobody really knows why men produce quite so many sperm. There's an inordinate number. It's probably in one ejaculation, a man may produce as many sperm as approximately as there are people in the United States. And nobody really knows why it has to be quite that many and why they have to be quite so small. You might almost argue that just a few very big sperm that can swim particularly fast might be more efficient, certainly in a case where, if you imagine women are actually mating with more than one man, you might imagine there was actually going to be competition between sperm from different males. And yet there doesn't seem to be much of a trend to have big, faster swimming sperm. So to answer the question of why men produce so many sperm, I don't think anybody really knows.
Now, obviously, one thing that has to happen during those first weeks of pregnancy is that the mother's body needs to stop menstruating. There needs to be some kind of a signal sent so that the embryo is not flushed out of her body. But isn't this actually rather rare in the animal world?
Menstruation itself is a relatively uncommon phenomenon. You only really see it in humans and our very close relatives, the higher apes. It doesn't really happen to a very great extent in really any other group of mammals. Obviously, many people, so presumably many women, would like to know exactly why this is, because it does seem to be an unbelievably inconvenient thing to have happen. The only reason that we really have a good reason for why women are thought to menstruate is that what they're actually shedding at the end of each cycle is they're shedding, obviously, the thickened lining of the uterus, the lining of the womb. And that lining would otherwise have been the sort of bed into which the embryo was destined to implant. The other thing that's very characteristic of humans and higher apes is that the embryo invades very, very aggressively into the uterine wall. And so it's been suggested that a very extra thick lining is needed to actually absorb the ferocity of its attack. And this may be why the lining in this small group of primates, which obviously includes us, is so thick that it actually can't be just simply reabsorbed every cycle. It actually has to be shed.
It's fascinating to hear you describe what happens at the cellular level. It's almost as if there's a military action going on here. You use words like attack and defend.
Well, it's an interesting one because when you first look at it, it does seem like a very sort of aggressive attack from the embryo. But obviously, it's in the interest of both the mother and the baby that the pregnancy is successful. And we assume that at some stage there must be a sort of balance struck, a sort of truce agreed between the mother and the baby, in which they agree on how far the baby is allowed to go. One thing that has come out just in very recent years is that there seems to be a bit of a battle between the genes that the baby carries. Babies seem to be able, certainly before birth, they seem to be able to tell which of the genes they got from their father and which of the genes they got from their mother. And there now seems to be quite a lot of evidence that genes from the father are desperately trying to make the baby grow as quickly as possible, whereas some genes from the mother, equivalent genes, are actually switched off to try and make the baby just moderate its growth a bit. Because obviously the father wants a strong, healthy child, whereas the mother, although she does want a strong, healthy child, she also doesn't want her body to be wrecked by the sheer size of the child. And so there does seem to be, if not a battle between the baby and the mother, there certainly seems to be some sort of battle between the parents going on.
How long does it take for the fetus to start to look like a baby?
Quite a remarkable amount of its development is really finished by about day 50, really, so about 7 weeks after fertilization. Obviously, after 7 weeks, it's still very, very small, but lots of the actual folding and forming of arms and legs and various bits and pieces of the body really is finished by that time. It does seem to be that really whatever size an animal is going to be eventually, even if it's going to be something like a whale, it seems to be easier to do all the very intricate bits of knitting together the body when the embryo is still very small.
Now, part of the fascination with this whole subject of pregnancy is what we might call the freaks of nature. And you write about some fascinating cases. One is where a fetus actually has another fetus inside it.
This is quite an uncommon thing to happen. But one of the processes that goes on when a baby is forming at a very early age, at a very early stage of pregnancies, that a baby really starts off as a flat sort of plate, if you like, and then folds over into a tube. And that tube, the middle of the tube, is their gut, which will obviously eventually form their stomach and intestines. And what can happen is that if you have two embryos that are developing and one, for some reason, is much larger than the other, then accidentally the larger embryo can actually, in its folding process, actually entrap the smaller embryo within it. And that embryo, the embryo that's trapped within it, obviously can't grow normally, but it often grows into something which looks like a sort of a very tiny vestigial baby. And these things are often found, well, not often, but when they are found, they're usually found sitting inside the abdomen, often deriving their blood supply from one of their larger twins' organs, like usually part of the intestine. I think perhaps they've only really been discovered recently because they're the sort of thing they were just picked up by chance on X-ray, really. Perhaps before the last few decades, lots of people may have gone through life with these things inside them and just never realized.
So this could be not only a young child, but actually an adult who's carrying around this tiny fetus in a way.
Yes, I think it can. I mean, very often I think they are picked up during childhood when children complain of abdominal pain. A mass is found in their abdomen, and yet when, and obviously when you find a mass in a child's abdomen, you always fear the worst. But then when it's investigated and x-rays are taken, you actually find that this thing has many of the sort of components of the skeleton of a tiny vestigial baby. And then at that point, these things are nowadays, obviously, they're surgically removed. But I think in the past, these people just sort of had to suffer the pain and lived into adulthood with these things.
Now, we've been talking mainly about what happens during a woman's pregnancy. But I suppose the final mystery in this whole story is the moment of birth and how the baby can adapt to an entirely different environment.
This is the time at which suddenly the great control freak, the human baby, suddenly finds that it's thrown out into an unfriendly world and it just has to cope. And really, it has a list of priorities of things that it has to deal with when it's born. The very first thing it has to do, obviously, is it suddenly has to start breathing, because if it doesn't do that, then obviously its outlook isn't very good. And there's a lot of preparation that goes on in the womb for this baby's actually practice breathing. But then it's suggested that what happens effectively is when they're born, first of all, the actual squashing process that they go through as they're being born actually squashes their lungs down. Then when they're born, they actually sort of recoil. There's a sort of elastic recoil that sucks air in. But probably much more important than that is there's obviously when they hit the cold air, the cold actually makes them gasp. And once they've taken that first breath and opened up their lungs, then really it's a lot easier from then on. And one of the most famous examples of this was actually the Russian painter Marc Chagall, who, when he was born, everybody thought the baby was dead. But the wily old Russian midwife dropped him into a bucket of ice water, and that immediately made him start breathing. And this was a sort of recurring theme in his rather dreamlike paintings for the rest of his life.
David Bainbridge teaches comparative anatomy and physiology at the Royal Veterinary College in London. Steve Paulson spoke with him about his book, Making Babies, The Science of Pregnancy.